Thanks be to God for this Sunday morning, last Sunday before our nation's birthday, a day here in Boston, a city of great consequence for the nation and the world. This morning, we are surrounded and enveloped in a light rain and high humidity. It is an extraordinary day to gather. And I send blessings today to my dear friend, Dean Robert Allen Hill and Jan, and to all those who share in ministry and leadership with them here. In the sermon, Transformed Nonconformists, Martin King said these words, "The most pressing need of this hour is a dedicated circle of transformed nonconformists. If our world is to be saved from its pending doom, it will come not through the complacent adjustment of the conforming majority, but through the creative maladjustment of a nonconforming minority. If the world is to be lifted from the morass of confusion and chaos, it will be done by men and women who have succeeded in standing above the world so that God can lift it through them," end quote. I've just returned from the Republic of South Africa. I traveled with a class of students. It was a class on moral leadership in international context. Emory University's Candler School of Theology sponsors these trips periodically. There were 2 weeks, 3 faculty, 15 students, and we visited the breathtakingly beautiful sites of that country at the bottom of the world. If you have not been, I hope that you will place it on your bucket list. It is truly an extraordinary sight. There's nothing quite like Table Mountain, some of you know and have seen. It reaches up into the distant clouds, and the top is indeed as flat as your kitchen table. At the southern tip of the continent lies Cape Point, where stunning mountains cascade down into the ocean, where penguins and whales, baboons and seals frolic in the sun. That beauty juxtaposes uneasily alongside the most creative horrors humans have devised for one another. We saw the prison on Robben Island, where Nelson Mandela spent 18 of his 27 years of incarceration. Not unlike Alcatraz, a cold, stone, medieval prison camp on an island just 8 miles from a breathtaking shore and cosmopolitan city. We stood in Mandela's tiny prison cell and looked out the window at a courtyard. A moral giant spent nearly 20 years in this small cage. We worshiped in the Methodist Church and met the former pastor, Peter Story, who broke ranks with other white South African Christians to demand equal treatment for the nation's black residents. And we worshiped at Regina Mundi, the Catholic Church in Johannesburg, where movement leaders in Soweto met and prayed and sang for strength to confront social evil. But the highlight of the trip was the time we spent with the truly legendary moral leaders who helped usher in a new South Africa. What was that King, that phrase by Dr. King? If the world is to be lifted from the morass of confusion and chaos, it will be done by people who have succeeded in standing above the world so that God can lift it through them. We met some of those people. We drew inspiration from the Reverend Frank Chikane, soft-spoken, short in stature, but magnificent in spirit. He led the South African Council of Churches. During the worst years of apartheid, he himself was imprisoned and tortured. We sat with him in a circle as he spoke of his torture sessions. The torturers applied electric shocks and burned his flesh. They taunted, "Mr. Shekhani, you've spoken to thousands and thousands in churches and football stadiums, but now here you are crying like a baby." We sat with Barney Pityana, best friend to Steve Biko, a charismatic and dynamic student leader who challenged racism and was banned by the government. He spent his entire adolescence and young adulthood looking over his shoulder for authorities who wanted him dead. He later became president of the nation's largest university, UNISA, University of South Africa. But our emotional and intellectual high point came when we sat and spent precious time with Archbishop Desmond Tutu, winner of the 1984 Nobel Peace Prize, president of the South African Council of Churches, leader of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. How many of you recall the moment when the TRC, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, met to hear the confessions of police officers, military leaders, and even gang members speak openly about the horrors they committed against other human beings? Women brutalized, protesting school children shot down in the streets in 1976, fathers tortured and hacked to death, proud neighborhoods razed, a lifetime of building burned overnight. The catalog of outrages stacked one upon another began to rise high in those TRC commission hearings. Outside that hearing room, nature whispered its constancy and faithfulness. Clouds gathered around Table Mountain as they have done for thousands of years. The pelicans soared gracefully along the shore. Penguins and whales danced in the ocean. But there in that room, Ingrid de Kock wrote a poem about the first meeting of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in April 1996, East London, South Africa. She wrote, "On the first day, after a few hours of testimony, the Archbishop wept. He put his gray head on the long table of papers and protocols, and he wept. The national and international cameramen filmed his weeping, his misted glasses, his sobbing shoulders, the call for a recess. It doesn't matter what you thought of the Archbishop before or after, of the settlement, the commission, or what the anthropologists flying in from less studied crimes and sorrows said about the discourse, or how many doctorates, books, and installations followed, or even if you think this poem simplifies, lionizes, romanticizes, mystifies. There was a long table, starched purple vestment, and a few hours of testimony. The Archbishop, the chair of the commission, laid down his head and wept. That's how it began," end quote. A preacher in South Africa wept over the brokenness and sinfulness of that self-declared Christian nation. But those tears are matched by those of our native son as we prepare to enter the season of July 4, celebrating our national history, our independence. Writing in his letter from Birmingham jail about the failure of courage exhibited by Alabama's white churches during the civil rights protests, Martin King wrote, "In deep disappointment, I have wept over the laxity of the church. But be assured that my tears have been tears of love. There can be no deep disappointment where there is not deep love. Yes, I love the church. How could I do otherwise? I'm in the rather unique position of being the son, the grandson, and the great-grandson of preachers. Yes, I see the church as the body of Christ, but oh, how we have blemished and scarred that body through social neglect and through fear of being nonconformists. And so here we are today, approaching a season where there will be great celebration, as there should be. But I would submit to you this morning that Independence Day, next week, July 4th, should function as a moral checkpoint for all of us. The church in America, the Christian church, a moral checkpoint. I believe that we are called during those checkpoints to recalibrate our moral compass. As believers, we peer into a chaotic world and into an uncertain future as we seek God's direction and God's guidance. This world is in a mess. And unlike in days past, where the church, synagogue, mosque, other houses of worship were sources of direction and hope, the society has lowered its expectation for believers. If we speak and serve and struggle, some few may notice, but most will ignore. That is part of what I see in today's text that was read, a recalibration. Jesus goes to his home congregation there in the Gospel of Luke, chapter 4. He reads a familiar passage from Isaiah 61. He interprets the scripture to suggest that God's love of humanity is more inclusive than we have been led to believe. The congregation resents being decentered. It is a difficult sermon that calls them to reach out to the poor, the hungry, victims of history and political economy. How do they respond? Their response is not contained in today's part of the lectionary, but if you read further in Luke 4, you find that things go sideways quickly. People are angry. They think this sermon will cost us too much. The implications of this are too disruptive. The preacher is quickly disinvited from any further words in that chamber. Maybe like being disinvited from delivering the State of the Union address to Congress. The philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer said, and I quote, "All truth passes through three stages. First, it is ridiculed. Second, it is violently opposed. And third, it is accepted as being self-evident." And so amidst our income and wealth inequality, racial and ethnic polarization, the despair and aimlessness of many of our young people, we confront Dr. King's persistent patient gaze. As we observe partisan divisions and growing mistrust and hatred in our nation, on July 4th, that moral checkpoint, that invitation to recalibrate our moral compass, pause a moment that morning and ask, what have I done in the past 12 months to move the arc of the moral universe toward greater justice, reconciliation, and truth? What have I done? What have we done to ensure that the next generation gets it right? What if the future of this city, Boston, or the city from which you now listen, what if the future of that community, especially the quality of race and ethnic relations, depends entirely on the actions of the people seated in this sanctuary? How could we possibly begin to approach such a question? Might we do nothing and watch history unfold around us? Might we simply grow angry at the messengers, as they did in Luke chapter 4? As we move through this season, this moral checkpoint for America, what can we do that might add value? What new, imaginative, bold thing can Marsh Chapel at Boston University do to help us bring peace and reconciliation? What are we willing to risk? Let us not be too timid or afraid to fail. The poet Goethe said, "Dream no small dreams, for they have no power to move the hearts of people." If we succeed and add value, then we will have come close to standing above the world so that God can lift it through us. And if we fail, we will fail standing next to the moral leaders of South Africa and the greatest patriots of our own nation. For even in failing, we fail forward. In falling, we can fall forward. The spiritual writer and Franciscan Richard Rohr reflects on this dynamic in his wonderful essay, Gazing Upon the Mystery. I quote, "The genius of Jesus' ministry is that he reveals how God uses tragedy, suffering, pain, betrayal, and death itself, not to punish us, but in fact to bring us to God and to our true self, which are frequently discovered simultaneously. There are no dead ends in the spiritual life. Nothing is above or beyond redemption. Everything can be used for transformation." G.K. Chesterton said it best, "The Christian faith hasn't been tried and found wanting. It has been found difficult and left untried." But as we approach July 4, I ask, will you dream and try new things for the healing of our nation? Or will you remain on the sidelines, attending only to the familiar, the safe, and the proximal? Blaise Pascal said, "God has instituted prayer so as to confer upon humans the dignity of being causes." You can be a cause in this season. Well, I began with Martin, and I conclude with Mary. What will you do now, and what will we do without the voice of Mary Oliver, that extraordinary poet? For as I hear Martin calling, if the world is to be lifted above the morass of confusion and chaos, it will be done by people who have succeeded in standing above the world so that God can lift it through them. And Mary responds, "I want to think again of dangerous and noble things. I want to be light and frolicsome. I want to be improbable, beautiful, and afraid of nothing, as though I had wings." Martin calls, faith is taking the first step, even when you don't see the whole staircase. Mary responds, keep some room in your heart for the unimaginable. Marsh Chapel, July 4th is coming. We will remember and celebrate great patriots, transformed nonconformists, George Washington and Abigail Adams, Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass. Yes, they ask us, will you take up the cross, suffering and sacrifice for the common good? Are we willing to experience redemptive discomfort? Martin responds, the time is always right to do what is right. And Mary says, tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? Thanks be to God for all the prophets and poets and patriots and witnesses who endured redemptive suffering, and they live on now to tell about it.